Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is English choral composer, conductor, and singer Bob Chilcott. Ever since the mid-1960s, when as a young treble vocalist he sang the opening solo verse for the internationally broadcast Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols at the King's College Chapel in Cambridge, Chilcott has been a force in English choral music. Today he's become one of the most widely performed composers of choral music in the world, in a career that has spanned singing and arranging for the King Singers, the internationally renowned a cappella group, choral conducting at the Royal College of Music in London, and being the principal guest conductor of the BBC Singers. But since 1997, his primary focus has been composition. And among his larger works, the Salisbury Vespers was premiered with a performance at the Cathedral with over 600 singers and players. His large-scale cantata, The Angry Planet, was premiered at the 2012 BBC Proms. Most recently, he wrote a piece, The King Shall Rejoice, for the service at Westminster Abbey to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. Even his smaller works are very popular with choruses around the world. He's in Tulsa for a residency with the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus, which has included a conducting workshop, a choral clinic for children's choirs, a community sing, which will take place Saturday morning, as well as a performance by the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus of his St. John's Passion, Saturday evening at 7:30 at the First Baptist Church at 4th in Cincinnati. He'll be conducting the chorus in that performance, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Bob Chilcott, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It's my pleasure.
I know a lot of choristers are looking forward to your work here because you're doing several workshops during the course of your time. But let's talk a little bit about the piece that you're going to be performing with the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus. This is just written a few years ago, the St. Yes. John's Passion. In just the name of it, you know, you're looking at big shoes to fill. I mean, Bach, St. Yes. John's Passion. What was the inspiration for doing this particular piece?
Well, I was asked to write it by the choir of Wells Cathedral in the west of England, which is actually one of our finest cathedral choirs. And at the beginning, I was quite fearful about it because, you know, the precedence, it's kind of big. But I sang the Evangelist part, actually, as a singer in both the Bach Passions a number of times. I knew those works well, and I also listened to other settings. There's a fine one by Arvo Pärt and one by the Scottish composer James McMillan, and I had to think about how I was going to make the piece work for me and for the choir, and I thought it through for a long time, and when I kind of figured things out, I thought I'm going to do this, and I'm glad I did, I have to say, because it was a great experience for me writing that work and trying to tell that story in some sort of musical shape.
A lot of times, if you're doing a sacred text, you're dealing with a text that is well-established, Latin most of the time, or maybe an English translation, and you're basically going off a version of the Bible in some way, but the Passion's a little different. You're telling the story.
Yes, it's a drama. It's the greatest story ever. It's a wonderful story with a great dramatic shape, actually, and I had to try and find how to make that work. And I looked for ways of using the choir because in the reality, it's a story. So the role of the choir is a strong role. So I set some meditations, some settings of early English poetry, actually about the crucifixion or about one's own relationship with God.
Are these the hymns that are part of this?
Well, no, actually, no. These are the sort of choir movements, the choir meditations. And I found these poems. And that was really a very interesting part of it for me because I wanted to find a way of expressing a kind of human view of, you know, in most of the poems, they don't want to give up the world. They want to stay alive because they like the world and everything that it has to offer. But it's about sort of coming to terms with one's own mortality, actually, the poems. And then I decided, too, that I wanted the choir to have a role together with the congregation, because originally the piece was written as a concert stroke liturgical performance on Palm Sunday, and we had a full cathedral, and so I decided to write some hymn settings. Never written a hymn in my life before that, and I loved doing it. And the first time it was done, the moment when the congregation stood up and sang the first hymn, we had the melodies written in the program. It was a fantastic moment, and I knew I'd done something which everyone embraced the whole thing and were embraced within that building. It was quite wonderful.
So you never written hymns before?
No. I've sung lots of hymns.
Well, you know, the whole thing about it, when you look at a lot of contemporary hymns, it's like, who wrote this?
It's absolutely right.
Because a lot of times the text is so much more important than the music, and the music is sort of cobbled together to fit the text a lot of times. And for a composer to, I mean, this is, you have to go back 80 years before you really, or 50 or 60 years for people who are really writing wonderful, wonderful hymns. And that's what I find really interesting about this. It's absolutely singable by a congregation. The hymns in this piece sort of have that wonderful feeling of having been there for about 60 or 70 years, you know? I mean, they're somewhat modern, but at the same time, they have a timelessness to them.
Well, thank you for saying that, because as in this country, I mean, hymns singing, certainly for us in Britain, and if you were a choir singer like I've been all my life, hymns were the kind of, that was your bread and butter. And when I was at school, after I left choir school, I went to school near London. I was there at the time when you sang a hymn every morning in all the school did. So you went to what we called assembly and you sang hymns. And I'll tell you, that was like being at a football match because people just yelled these melodies out. But there was something very, very viscerally exciting about, you know, all these young men, boys aged between about 11 and 18, belting in this kind of adolescent way For All the Saints by Vaughan Williams, or, you know, some great Jerusalem. I remember when we sang that, I never got through it without crying. You know, it's pathetic. Right. But to hear everyone belting that tune out was great.
Well, you know, you mentioned the soccer matches. The only time I've ever heard Americans sing the national anthem at full voice was at a World Cup qualifier where another country did exactly the same thing with their national anthem, and Americans looked at each other and go, oh, I guess we really need to sing this.
It's great.
And then there's something about that British tradition, you know, whether you're at a soccer match where you guys are singing full throat for 90 minutes or in a morning assembly with the required anthem for him.
Marvelous. Actually, the terrible bombings in Paris the other day, that it just so happened that 2 days after that happened, England and France had a football-soccer game in Wembley, which they played. And they decided that everyone was going to sing the French national anthem, and they put the words up, and they asked the supporters, you know this before you come.
Yeah.
And I suspect that there wasn't a person in that stadium that wasn't deeply affected by that. And I find that rather, that's a message. I love it. Singing's done it, you know.
And then singing has that power.
It does. It does.
Now, was one of the poems for St. John's Passion, Away Vain World?
Yeah.
Now, what was this poem? How did you find this particular poem?
It's one I found by a Scottish poet, actually, from the, I think it's 16th century. But what's marvelous about this poem is that the verses kind of divide up into two feelings. And I've done it very simply in the music, where I've changed the key halfway through to give it a different color. In the first bit, he's saying, away vain world, it's saying, my time's up. But I don't want to go because I like, you know, I like all the things about the world that you shouldn't like, you know. And then in the second half, he says, but I'm going to be okay because I'm going to a place where I'll be taken care of and I'll feel that love. And I found that beautiful because it's a real human expression of something that we all feel. And you know, when your time's up, basically. But it's a thing of coming to terms with it. And the fact that in the story, Jesus was a human being on the earth probably had to do that too. I mean, it was about human form is ending for you. So come to terms with it. And it does beautifully in this poem. I love the poem. I was deeply affected by it. And I wrote it actually the very week that my father-in-law died of pancreatic cancer. He was a very distinguished musician, Sir Philip Ledger. And I can hear him saying, well, you know, I agree with this. I've enjoyed my life, but, you know, I'll do my best now.
It's a wonderful setting. I think people ought to hear it. Let's play a little bit. This is from the Wells Cathedral choir, a version of the St. John's Passion, Away Vain World, written by my guest today, Bob Chilka.
Yes, we lie.
That's music from Bob Chilcott's St. John's Passion, A Way, Vain World. The Tulsa Oratorial Chorus will be presenting his St. John's Passion Saturday evening. And Bob Chilcott is my guest. He'll be conducting the group. And that must be a really interesting thing coming. You do this all the time. You come into a group of choral singers, and basically they've been prepared, but you have to sort of weld them into the idiosyncrasies of the way you like to hear your music. What are the sort of keys to doing that?
I don't have a choir of my own. So actually, coming to do these type of things, it's a real joy for me. Because as a composer, I always felt I wanted to be a composer that communicated with the ordinary singers, of which there are many, and they're very fine. When I sang in the group The King's Singers, which, you know, is, and I'm a trustee of them now, and I listen to them and I think, did I sing in that group? They're fantastic, you know. and everything is beautifully honed and beautifully done. And for the, you know, for the ordinary singer to do sometimes the simplest thing is very, very hard. And I love that challenge of enabling people to feel good about their singing, because singing is a fragile thing, and people come with their own goodwill and their own energy to enjoy it and make it feel good for themselves, and they give so much. For me, the challenge is to take what they bring and make them feel good about that, and that's the joy of it for me.
Well, you'll have that opportunity in Tulsa, because you're doing another event that you sort of do on a regular basis. I believe you call them Come and Sings, but you're doing one Saturday morning with a group of Tulsa instrumentalists. Is there a different approach you take when you're doing like a community event?
Yes. Or something like that? I've done a lot of these things. Actually, the person who really got them going in our country was John Rutter, and he still does a lot of them. And, you know, a lot of people turn out to sing with him. And I actually, in Britain, quite a lot of people turn out to sing with me. And what we do, people come to sing. Generally, most of the music is my own, and they come and sing through pieces. And what is interesting in our country is you have all sorts of people of different levels. So you get some people who are established sort of oratorio singers in singing a choir. You get a lot of church choir people. You get a lot of community choir people. So we've got a lot of growing number of community choirs in our country. And then you always get some people who've never sung before. I did an event recently where this lady, she was a marketing director for a company worldwide. Very bright woman, beautiful woman too, actually. And she came to this day and she said, I want to do this. And she put on a day for me, and she said, since that day, when I'd never sung in my life, I now sing in a choir. And she said, and I put this day on. Well, of course, because she was a dynamo, this day was fantastic. It was full of energy, and she got people along in a good way, and they come along, and the whole idea is just to sing, and you see what happens. You kind of sing at the beginning of the day. I do a few exercises, and I've worked out exercises that make people sing, you know, in harmony straight away. And you, some days you hear it and you think, ooh, today's going to be a long day. And then sometimes you hear it, you know, we've got 40 tenors. Fantastic. You know, we'll do well today. But I love doing them. I've done a few in this country here, particularly in Washington, D.C. We pioneered a couple of days like this there, and we've done quite well with them. And they're a lot of fun, actually. And there's no pressure. That's the thing. People can just go and come along.
Just about having a good time for a day.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Now, you do spend a lot of time in this country. In fact, you have a great relationship with a choir in New Orleans.
Yes, I
do. You've premiered a couple of pieces down there. Tell us about that relationship.
Well, I started rather late on writing music for young voices. So I've been involved in this country, particularly with a lot of children's choir festivals. And there's one in New Orleans with the New Orleans Children's Chorus where we get 400 kids come along and sing. And, you know, I say kids, but they're adolescent, generally young women who sing at an unbelievably high level. And I remember, I think it was last year, I conducted the Louisiana All-State Women's Chorus, so kind of high school women, and we did a performance. And I can quite honestly say it's some of the best singing I've ever heard in my life. Beautiful people who sang with their hearts. I loved it, actually. Yeah. And then there's another festival out in Oregon, which I've been involved with for 5 years. Again, youth choirs, they come from all over the place. And actually, this next year, I'm going there. It's in Eugene, and I've written a piece for this big youth choir, and we're doing it with a group from Los Angeles called the Yellow Jackets, a jazz.
Oh yeah, right. Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's a kind of funky jazz piece which we're doing, and they're going to perform with these kids, which is just brilliant. I'm, you know, sometimes serendipitous things like that can happen, and I'm really excited about
it. One of the things I'm amazed about your work is the fact that you are so wide in your influences. You've written a jazz mass that is actually very jazzy.
Well, I'm, yeah.
That works, you know what I mean?
I know what you mean, yeah.
And you mentioned the children's choir. I have to ask about probably one of your most famous pieces, and that is Can You Hear Me? Do you use sign language?
Yeah, well, when I was in the King Singers, we did a lot of concerts with deaf people. And I did I wrote a piece, actually, for a very famous British percussion player called Evelyn Glennie, profoundly deaf percussionist. Beautiful woman, very, very, very fine player. And we did performances for people who couldn't hear. And also there was this charismatic musician who turned out to be a great signer. And he did, when he signed, he looked like he was sort of break dancing. And he would stand on the, he did a lot of signing for West End shows.
Right.
So, and he's brilliant at it. And he did a number of things that I was involved in, and I loved it. And I thought, I'm going to write a piece which involves the signing, because it was a song about someone who has to deal with something personally, but actually they feel quite happy about the, you know, it's a very positive song. And I involved signing in because actually when you're a singer and you move, it can be very expressive to help you sing better. Because we tend to stand very still when we sing, but when you move, suddenly you become more aware of yourself and more aware of what you're doing, and it's been a powerful tool that with young people. I've loved it actually, and a long time ago I sang with a ballet company in Britain called the Ballet Rambert, and we did a program of some very eclectic music by Kurt Weill and I can't remember who else, but it was marvellous. And all the dancers wanted to be singers, and us singers wanted to be dancers. You know, it was this thing of thinking, I love what they do, you know. Wish we could. Right. My wife would say she wouldn't want me to be a dancer, but on the other hand, there's something very liberating about moving when you sing.
No, absolutely. And you know, you were talking about Evelyn Glennie, and of course, you know, she hears music through the feeling of, you know, the sound is being transmitted through the waves, through feeling.
Yes.
I'm wondering if the same thing happens for a deaf audience hearing a choral piece, if they're feeling the music as opposed to actually hearing it.
Yes, it certainly does. And you realize that when you hear music live, which is, of course, the best way to hear music, you're influenced by so many other factors, by the visual, by the way you feel inside the building and the connection that you have with your performance. And we often forget that actually music in its best form is when you go and hear it live and you get this interaction between the audience and the performers. And I think you can have that. It's not all about just hearing it, even though, you know, I suspect for a lot of people it would be quite nice to hear it, but it's not always the case.
Earlier, I was talking about this wide range. I assume a lot of this came from your years with the King Singers, because you were doing all sorts of repertoire, yes. And many times you were writing a lot of that repertoire. Right. Did that sort of open your ears to hearing all sorts of different music, or has that always been a part of who you are
as a singer? It's always been a part of whom I was in my early career. I was an arranger for the BBC Radio 2, which was big band and string orchestra. So it was a real old-fashioned kind of Hollywood-style orchestra.
So you're singing a close six-part close harmony?
I used to write charts for singers. Uh-huh. So solo singers used to come in and conductors. I did that for a while. But actually, what I love about the King Singers, and I do now, is how open they are to different types of music. And I think it really taught us to take music on its own terms, and I've always been a great advocate for that. You know, there's music to love in every sphere, and I've been lucky enough in my life to work with musicians from all different backgrounds who give what they give with their heart, and that's all you want to do as a musician to give what you can personally. And that, I mean, what you will give is completely different to what I will give. But to accept that and go with it and give what you can.
Now, the King Singers came from King's College, which is where you started as a young treble. Yeah. And you were talking about your father-in-law, Philip Ledger, who led that choir for a while, and a great musician. Of course, on our station on Christmas Eve every year, it's a tradition that we have a festival of nine lessons and carols in the afternoon of Christmas Eve in England. And you were a part of that service for many years, and you sang that beginning solo of Once in Royal David City.
I did.
And I have to ask, you did it, I guess, 3 years, is that right?
I did it 3 years running, yeah.
What is that feeling like when you're, I mean, is it just another, I mean, first of all, that choir is singing all the time anyway. Yeah. Is there a special sort of trepidation knowing this is going all around the world?
Yes, but actually, the conductor who we had, Sir David Wilcox, who when I was a boy, when I did it, he was very encouraging. And we used to stand in the part of the chapel surrounded by people, and they always at 3 o'clock in England, when the service goes out live, they read the news first. So 2 minutes of the news, and there's a white light on this long pole, and they would say, when it turns red, start. And of course, the first, it's in G major for the musicians out there, the Once in Royal David City. And so I had to hum the note to David Wilcox. And of course, he was nervous, and I would blow the note on a pitch pipe, and then he would say, sing me the note, like this in the very, and I would go, and he'd say, no, it's, and it was very nerve-wracking, because the first verse unaccompanied, and then the choir sings an unaccompanied verse, and then the organ comes in third verse with the congregation.
So it's got to
be in tune.
That's right. It's got to be in tune.
Yeah.
You're singing an unaccompanied voice. All these people who wait for hours to get in there
exactly.
for that service. And you're giving the pitch to the rest of the choir.
Exactly. It was...
No pressure.
No pressure. I survived. But it was a marvelous thing to have done. And it's a difficult solo because like a lot of hymns, and I thought about it too when I wrote the hymns in my passion. You have to always have hymn tunes that ordinary folk can sing within their own range. And I've found when I go to our church and I sing hymns, I sing the first line and I think, oh, I'm in good voice today. I get to line three and my voice is packing up. You know, they're hard to sing hymns and they're hard to sing well and get in tune. And so, yeah, that was.
I've always wanted to know what goes through the mind of one of those young trebles who's singing and has to be aware that, you know, this is being broadcast worldwide.
They're brave. But, you know, those little chaps, they're really fine musicians. And, you know, they're well briefed. They know what they've got to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask about an upcoming performance you have. You were talking about how daunting it was to tackle the St. John's Passion, which you'll be doing Saturday night with the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus. My guest today is composer Bob Chilcott, who will be leading the chorus in his own St. John's Passion. You have a world premiere coming up later, I believe it's this year, in Washington, of Gloria.
I do. I've the last 18,
this is another one of those sort of iconic pieces that if it goes well, they'll be singing it for, 100 years.
I know. I'm hoping it's going to be my pension. Actually, I've been composing residence of a choir in D.C. called Choralis, a big choir, very good choir. And we've done a few concerts over the last 18 months, but I've written this piece. It's the end of my tenure as composer in residence, and I'm doing it at the beginning of December. And I'm really looking forward to it, actually. We're doing it in a downtown church. And like my passion, it's with a brass quintet, organ, and timpani. Because actually, one of the considerations for any choir now is, you know, you have to be able to make accompaniments financially viable. I know it sounds a straight, but you know, to rent an orchestra is really expensive. So, I've focused quite a lot on small ensemble accompaniments. And I'll tell you, when you get organ and brass quintet and timpani. It's a big sound.
Yes, it is.
And I love brass instruments. And I have to say, I like brass players. I know you're one yourself, but I like brass players. They're a bit like singers.
In what way?
Well, they play like singers because it's all to do with vocal line. I remember we did a lot of recording of Gabrielli when I was a student. We did a lot of we sang with a lot of brass groups, and also we played with a lot of people who played sackbuts and cornets, which were very vocal in their sound. And I think brass players, you know, it's quite high pressure playing the brass instrument. And it's a bit like being a singer. You face outwards and you're quite vulnerable. And you know, you can crack or you can split a note as a singer. I find them very similar. So temperamentally, they tend to be quite similar. And I've always enjoyed brass players.
So what was the inspiration for the composition of this Gloria? What were the things you wanted to achieve with this piece that... It'll be coming out.
Well, a piece I love is the Vivaldi Gloria, which of course a lot of people will know well. But as a setting of the Gloria, it's unmatched. It's brilliant. It has this, it has incredible joyous power, but it also has huge introspection. And I like that. And I've tried to do that in the most well-known of texts. I think the John Rutter Gloria is a brilliant piece. You know, it's a difficult piece to bring off well. And again, he achieves that brilliantly in that piece with this very, very tender music and slightly acerbic, actually. I like this sort of Stravinsky quality in the second movement of his piece. But I've conducted that a few times, and I enjoy that piece. So as a model, that was something I looked at and thought, if I got 10% of what he got or Vivaldi, I would be very happy. So that's been my... inspiration to make it's quite an energetic piece, but it has moments of great reflection, and I hope it goes well. They'll sing it well, I know that.
Well, we're looking forward to the St. John's Passion this Saturday night. A massive work, but also what I love about it, you have these five hymns that everybody gets to sing on. Yeah. There's some moments for the choir along with the soloists that are a part of this beautiful piece. And then I guess you're going to do a couple of other things of yours as well on the program.
Yes. In fact, the assistant conductor, Zach, is going to conduct those, which I'm looking forward to.
Bob Chilcott, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you very much.
English choral composer, conductor, and singer Bob Chilcott speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be conducting his work, The St. John's Passion, with the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus Saturday evening at 7:30 at the First Baptist Church at 403 South Cincinnati, as well as conducting a community sing Saturday morning at St. John's Episcopal Church. That gets underway at 10 o'clock. Details for both events are available at tulsachorus.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. We're going to leave you with more music from the St. John's Passion here on Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher.